You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 17th of July 2018 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily in association with UBS. Live from Midori House in London, this is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up...
In a key sentence in my remarks, I said the word would instead of wouldn't. The sentence should have been, I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be Russia. Sort of a double negative.
Man in hole keeps digging. Also ahead, the Golan Heights between Israel and Syria becomes a contentious frontier for a depressing new reason. Later in the show.
Each day's news cycles bringing more head spinning and disturbing headlines. I thought maybe it would be useful to step back for a moment and try to get some perspective.
We'll be deciphering remarks by an American president who had less trouble saying what he meant the first time. Plus, we'll have the latest from the Farnborough Air Show, a review of the newspapers, and a look at what might be the greatest flop in cinematic history. That's all coming up on the Monocle Daily Live from London, starting now. And welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Muller. If US President Donald Trump was expecting to be driven back to the White House from Andrews Air Force Base through a blizzard of rose petals flung by adoring fans agog at his performance at the Helsinki summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin, he will be presently feeling somewhat disappointed. The reviews are in, and they are not in general kind. At the extreme end, former CIA chief John Brennan has called Trump nothing short of treasonous, a capital crime, lest we forget, but even generally sympathetic media have either struggled or not even tried to support or even explain Trump's suggestion that the word of Russia's president is worth more than that of US intelligence. Within the last couple of hours, Trump himself has had a crack at it. It didn't go brilliantly.
I thought that I made myself very clear by having just reviewed the transcript. Now, I have to say, I came back and I said, what is going on? What's the big deal? So I got a transcript, I reviewed it. I actually went out and reviewed a clip of an answer that I gave. And I realized that there is a need for some clarification. It should have been obvious. I thought it would be obvious, but I would like to clarify just in case it wasn't. In a key sentence in my remarks, I said the word would instead of wouldn't. The sentence should have been, I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be Russia. Sort of a double negative.
I'm joined now by Suzanne Lynch, the Irish Times Washington correspondent. Suzanne, I'm not entirely sure where to start. This is real the dog ate my homework stuff, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, Donald Trump was not supposed to make any public comments today. There was nothing on his schedule apart from a meeting with Republican lawmakers at 2 p.m. And then an hour before that, the White House announced that he would indeed make a statement about the Helsinki summit. And this really is in reaction to the enormous barrage of criticism he has faced since arriving back here last night. We've seen it from Democrats, obviously, from former intelligence directors, but most importantly, from senior people within his own party. And it became increasingly clear that Donald Trump was going to have to address this. And as you heard there in that clip, he admitted himself that he didn't see what the problem was and that he was wondering what all the fuss was about. He put up this feeble excuse that he misspoke. But more significantly and more worryingly, he said that while he accepted the intelligence agency's assertion that Russia meddled in the election, he also said, but it could also be other people too. He continued, there are a lot of people out there. So this is what he said today. So we kind of have this half-baked attempt to backtrack on his statements that I don't think is really going to convince very many people.
I mean, it is hard to argue, at least with his assertion that there are a lot of people out there. That is certainly true. But among the American press, once they've, I guess, retrieved their jaws from the floor and their foreheads from their desks at this point, how have they been playing this over the last couple of hours since he made this, well, clarification seems the wrong word, but you know what I mean.
I don't think there is much appetite to forgive the president, if you like, on this. I think what we saw in the hours after the Helsinki summit was a kind of an uneasy quiet from the Republican side, and indeed from conservative commentators. I think everyone was quite shocked by the press conference with Putin, but was kind of watching to see what the next person would say and how they react. And then slowly we saw a trickle of Republican figures come out and criticise Donald Trump. And then this cascaded overnight with more people coming out and criticising him today. Now, I think there's been a lot of coverage about the fact that Fox News even were not that happy with the president. But, I mean, a lot of the coverage is still backing Donald Trump. One of the issues for Fox is that Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson both did interviews with President Trump after the summit in Helsinki. The Tucker Carlson interview is due to air tonight. So it leaves Fox News and these particular presenters in particular in a really tricky situation, because they've already kind of backed Trump, if you like, in these interviews. And now this situation got worse and worse over the last 24 hours. So I don't think it's a whole-scale backtracking by Fox News. We definitely did some commentators, at least, on that channel, who were at the very least saying that Donald Trump is having a difficulty separating the issue of Russian interference on one level and then the fact that there was no collusion by his team and Russia on the other. So they're giving him that, at least.
Do we get the impression that Trump himself has been somewhat spooked by the reaction? Because usually he is very much of the never apologise, never explain school, like all the world's worst people generally are. But this is one of those rare occasions on which he seemed almost contrite. Do we get the impression that quite serious people, or at least people that he takes seriously, have had a word with him?
I think that's what it is. I mean, I think you saw a very kind of half-hearted attempt by Donald Trump to apologise. He didn't really today. As I say, he still said that it could have been other people interfering in the election. So I think what we have seen today is an attempt. I think we have seen an effort by people close to Donald Trump, not just kind of friends who may talk to, Fox News people, etc., but people within his own team. One of the most remarkable ironies of the press conference with Vladimir Putin was that so many of Trump's own officials, people like John Bolton, these hawkish foreign policy advisors who are anything but pro-Russia, and were there in the room with him. So we saw Donald Trump actually not only do a solo run, but actually fly in the face of his own closest advisors. So I think what we saw is that the White House, the West Wing in a sense, urging Donald Trump to speak out today. And I think there was a reluctance by the president. You could see that there, that he still said in his comments today, oh, Russia did not result in any change to the election outcome. So we have a man who's still obsessed with anything that could try and undermine his own election success. You know, that was his real message today. So I think this was somebody who was reluctantly coming to the table and coming to the cameras today to try and backtrack what was a really disastrous performance on Monday.
I mean, amid all the nonsense which has circulated around Trump the last 24 hours, I think one of the things that has been forgotten and which still strikes me as the most important aspect of the Helsinki summit was this long conversation that he and President Putin had in camera, as it were, apparently nearly 2 hours, just the two of them with interpreters. Are we any nearer discovering what it was they might have discussed?
No, and I don't think we will do. There have been calls today from Democratic members of Congress for this issue to be addressed, for either someone like Mike Pompeo to come and appear before Congress. Indeed, there were calls for the translators who were present at that meeting to be subpoenaed. But ultimately, Donald Trump has a lot of power here. Presidents go in and have meetings quite a lot. There is very little that Congress can do here. So what Republicans who have, like people like Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan, who criticised the president today, they will be hoping, they, for example, said today that they're prepared to look at more sanctions on Russia, and they will be hoping that that will be enough to kind of quell this disquiet, particularly from the opposition bench in Congress. And that will be enough to kind of, you know, settle the issue, because I cannot see them being able to progress it more than that. But you're right, this is the big question now. I mean, we know what was said publicly, what was said privately, and that's what's really kind of unnerving people. And I think this could end up really being a serious issue for Donald Trump, even with his supporters. He likes to say that his base will keep with him no matter what. But now we have a president who essentially did not show he was strong, the strong man, the bully. He in fact showed somebody who was quite weak, who completely acquiesced to Vladimir Putin, and who basically was an appeaser. So I don't think that is going to play well with his base, with just the traditional Republicans, who are so much the party of law and order and the party of strong foreign policy. This seems to be completely at odds with what they believe a US president should be.
Do you get the sense that the outrage over this is going to last, or are we looking at the international diplomatic equivalent of something like Charlottesville, where for about 24, 48 hours, everybody seemed, you know, absolutely determined that this is the worst thing that could ever possibly happen, that there is no coming back from this, that this is the beginning of the end, and within a week, everybody had pretty much forgotten about it and moved on to whatever the next nonsense was?
Yes, I mean, this is always the question with Donald Trump. How low, much lower does he need to go before his party starts backing away from him? I do think there is a possibility that this could signal a sea change. As I say, the issue of foreign policy, people say that his base doesn't vote for that. But at the same time, if they see their leader being weak, and if they are being instructed by some commentators on Fox News that this was in fact not a good performance by the president, that might start seeping through into his poll numbers. In particular, we need to keep in the background what's happening in North Korea. There's been mumblings from North Korea that, you know, they're in fact, not surprisingly, not sticking to the plan to denuclearize. So if we have some negative stories on the North Korea front, coupled with this issue in Russia, I then think a combination of those factors could spell trouble for Donald Trump. But at the moment, I do think it's significant that people like Newt Gingrich, people like Anthony Scaramucci, his former communications director, have come out and criticized personally the president today. We have not seen this before. So that suggests that this could be something different, that this could, in fact, spell a change, a sea change in the presidency of Donald Trump.
Suzanne Lynch with the Irish Times in Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Summer is finally here, and so is Monocle's bumper July-August double issue. This is when we zero in on quality of life and cities, why we love them, what makes them actually work, and how they need to improve. As always, we reveal our ranking of the top 25 cities to live in worldwide. Find out if your city makes the cut. And for the first time, we present our manifesto for creating a more relaxed city. A guide to breathing in and lightening up, and a celebration of everything from taking your kit off to making a bit of a racket. In the affairs pages, we meet the urban heroes giving back to their hometowns. While in design, we take a closer look at greenery in the city and how to do it right. Elsewhere, we take a dip in Geneva's top swimming spot, we tuck into some northern Spanish grub, and we sit down for a mass with the locals in a few Bavarian beer gardens. Prost! That's all in the July-August issue of Monocle, on newsstands everywhere now. Or head to monocle.com to become a subscriber.
This is the Monocle Daily, live from Studio One at Midori House in London. The Golan Heights have been one of the world's most contentious frontiers since Israel took the region from Syria during the Six-Day War of 1967. A new dimension to that friction has appeared in recent days as thousands of Syrians fleeing an offensive by Russian-backed Syrian forces in the country's southeast have headed to the Heights seeking aid from or asylum in Israel. Though Israel has shipped aid to refugees encamped on the Heights and has taken in thousands who have required hospital treatment, it has refused to countenance a more general admission. Well, I'm joined now by Dr. Laura James, Middle East analyst at global advisory firm Oxford Analytica. Laura, first of all, what is the scale of this exflow? We have become wearily accustomed to large numbers of Syrians either moving around Syria or fleeing it altogether as the war develops. But in that context, how big is this?
This is in the tens of thousands. So I would say it's a medium-sized population movement for Syria if you look at it over the context of the whole war. But it is significant, and it's one of the biggest flows we've seen in the south for some time.
Why is a flow this big happening? Well, we hope it's late in this war. It's certainly a good 7 or 8 years into it. Has it just been that so far Syria's conflict has not really reached this part of the country?
The south has been insulated by the fact that it was set up as a de-escalation zone, and it was protected essentially by US and Jordanian interest from the south, and Russia and the Syrian government agreed that they wouldn't attack the rebels there, who equally weren't attacking them. So there was a status quo. But now Damascus has decided that it is time to take back the whole of the country, and the south of the country is the next step. And Jordan actually thinks this is a good idea because it will enable them to reopen the border to trade. The United States is standing back and not getting involved. So this big offensive has launched off, and there are bombing raids. People are scared. People are afraid of what will happen when the troops get to their homes. And so they're running for safety.
Well, on that last point, how clear are we on whether these people are fleeing the fighting in and of itself, which is obviously a perfectly reasonable thing to flee, or the Syrian army?
I think it's both. They're certainly scared of the Syrian army. They are worried about things like conscription, which they were obviously immune to when they were under rebel control. They're worried about reprisals if they're people who have somehow got on the blacklist of the regime of President Assad. But I think, to be honest, the major driver is probably the airstrikes and the uncertainty of the airstrikes. You know, it's not clear where will be targeted next, where might be hit. And it seems much safer on the Golan Heights because within reach of Israel, even if they're not actually in Israeli territory, then the Syrian government has to be much more careful about bombing or attacking them because they don't want to draw Israel into this conflict.
So what do we know about the conditions that these people are currently living in? Is there any provision being made for them? Is much aid being sent to them?
Aid is being shipped across the border. It's hard to get details on exactly how much compared with the need because it's changing every day, just in terms of the number of people there, as well as the amount that can get across. But it's quite a sensible place to be if you want to collect aid. It's hard to get aid really into Syria. The negotiations with the government are very complicated, and to some extent during an offensive, the government wants to cut areas off so that they're forced to surrender. So just across the Israeli border, there's quite a lot of scope for humanitarian aid to be shipped across, and certainly a lot has been coming.
I mean, Israel has admitted quite a lot of Syrians, running up over 3,000 by some counts in recent years, into Israel, you know, who require treatment for injuries received in the war. They have been quite clear that they would not countenance a more general admission. Does Israel have hard and fast rules about who it admits and who it doesn't, or does it just treat these things on a case-by-case basis?
I think the basic rule is refugees are not admitted. The idea is that the Arab population is quite sufficient in Israeli territory. They don't want any more people coming in, being refugees, having refugee status, and therefore potentially staying indefinitely if they're unable to return home. In fact, one Israeli minister said yesterday that, you know, there are plenty of rich Arab countries. Why don't they take them? So they are simply taking people for medical treatment. And that's a very temporary basis. They don't get any kind of status or right to stay.
Laura James at Oxford Analytica, thanks for joining us. You're listening to The Monocle Daily. Shortly, what's flying at Farnborough? But first, a look at what else is making news today. With timing that might have been designed to depress both the UK's leavers and remainers, the EU has concluded with Japan one of the biggest free trade deals ever signed, covering 600 million people and nearly a third of the world's GDP. The deal will eliminate almost all tariffs on goods traded between the EU and Japan. For Japanese consumers, it's likely to mean cheaper European pharmaceuticals and wines, among other commodities, while European motorists should find Japanese cars more of a bargain. Egypt's Parliament has passed a new law which will reclassify some social media presences as media outlets and harass and persecute them accordingly, although the language of the bill may dress this intention up somewhat. Any social media account, blog or website with more than 5,000 followers will be placed under the rarely forgiving supervision of Egypt's Supreme Council for Administration of the Media. The council is also empowered to block websites which displease it and file criminal charges against their operators. And North Korean state media has taken the unusual, indeed unprecedented, step of depicting the country's leader, Kim Jong-un, as other than delighted with the ongoing construction of his workers' utopia. Rodong Sinmun, a newspaper which regularly features photos of Kim beaming beatifically at tractors or pointing entranced at combine harvesters, has run a 9-page spread showing him grumbling at an incomplete power plant and fulminating at unclean bathtubs. In fairness, if Kim now thinks that the entire Western world is like the presidential suite of the St. Regis Hotel in Singapore, he could be forgiven for having adjusted his standards. This is the Monocle Daily. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. The 2018 iteration of the Farnborough International Airshow is underway here in the UK. It is not, regrettably, quite the aerial spectacular it once was, although it does still fill Hampshire's skies with some exotic aviation, enough to get perhaps 80,000 enthusiasts through the gates during the show. But Farnborough is more and more a business fair with hundreds of exhibitors and delegates from dozens of countries. Well, I'm joined with more by Sean Maffett, a commentator with Air Sound Aviation. Sean, on that air show, the actual air show aspect of it first, why has that shrunk in recent years?
Well, good evening, Andrew. Farnborough used to be possibly the greatest air show in the world. I actually went to the very first in 1948, which tells you how old I am. but it had absolutely everything. Recently, the flying display has deteriorated a lot because it's not a good place to have a flying display. There are too many built-up areas around. And after the Shoreham crash of 2015, when that Hunter crashed and killed so many people, all the regulations were tightened and all the things that were wrong with Farnborough as a site to have an air show suddenly became much more apparent. And it's now got to the stage where, for instance, the Royal Air Force doesn't do any displays at Farnborough. They do flypasts, they fly through, but they do not do their proper displays because they consider that the regulations there make it impossible for them to do it. That's how sad it has become. And I'm beginning to wonder if they can continue to have a flying display there, which would be immensely sad if they stopped it. But if you can't do a proper flying display, then, you know, maybe that's a way out.
So if you do come to Farnborough during the air show this year and, you know, at some point look up, what's the most exciting thing you are likely to see?
Well, there are wonderful teams still coming there, such as the Blades, a team of four extra 300 piston-engined aircraft, who are all ex-Red Arrows pilots, one of them the only woman Red Arrow pilot there's ever been. They do fantastic displays. They belong to a company called 2XL, and they arrive in formation with their oil spill airplane. So you see a 727 airliner with these guys in formation on the wingtips. There are also the Red Bull air racers, and there are fly-throughs by RAF aircraft, such as the Red Arrows and the Battle of Britain Memorial flight. So there is plenty of stuff to see in the air, but it's not like it used to be, and it's not as good as, you know, many other big air shows that happen in this country.
So on the ground then, what has business been like this year?
It's been fantastic. After the first 2 days, they've clocked up more than $98 billion worth of orders. I mean, that's $23 billion up on the same period at the 2016 show. It's an every other year show, so the last one was 2 years ago. So that, that is all working very well. The trade show part of it, goes from strength to strength. Interestingly, I actually only discovered this recently. The top 10 aerospace manufacturing countries last year were, not surprisingly, The United States is top at over $400 billion. France is next. China is next. And the United Kingdom is only fourth at $48 billion. So about a tenth of what the United States does. But still, nonetheless, lots of big orders are being placed at Farnborough.
So in among those big orders, what have been some of the more eye-catching deals done?
Well, interestingly, the two big manufacturers, Airbus and Boeing, they always differ slightly on their figures. Airbus forecasts over the next 20 years, 37,000 aeroplanes will be required, both to replace existing aeroplanes and also for new expanding markets. But Boeing thinks there'll be 43,000. So Boeing thinks, you know, 6,000 more aeroplanes over the next 20 years will be required to be built. So, you know, that's a good sign for the aviation industry. Of course, in this country, that doesn't take into account what might happen with Brexit. I mean, that's, you know, we could talk for the rest of the night about that. So maybe you'd want to leave that till later. But, you know, it does put a certain degree of uncertainty. Other things that are coming along, really long routes are coming online these days. For instance, the west coast of the United States to the Middle East, nonstop. New York to Singapore, nonstop. Newark, New Jersey to Hong Kong. You know, those are the kind of things that are developing these days.
Sean Moffat, thank you very much for joining us with the latest there from Farnborough. You are listening to The Daily. Now, on this week's episode of The Entrepreneurs, producer Daniel Bates travelled to Edinburgh to meet with fashion designer Keston Hare and his wife Gemma. Keston worked with a number of labels before returning to his hometown to launch his eponymous label in 2014. Gemma looks after brand marketing and strategy. Even with a shop in Shoreditch, the label is based at Custom Lane, 10 minutes from the city centre in Edinburgh. Daniel sat down with Keston and Gemma at Custom Lane to learn more about the brand.
I'm curious about the idea for setting out on your own, Keston, with your experience and putting a label with your own name, what that vision looked like and if it looks like the brand that you have today.
You kind of, doesn't matter what kind of discipline that you are, whether you're an architect or a photographer, you know, or a writer or you know, whatever, you're always kind of molded by your kind of experiences. You know, you're sort of taking every experience that you had, you know, along the route, and that becomes, you know, kind of the person that you are or the designer that you are today. So my experience, you know, particularly with Nigel Caborn, I did a little bit of work with Burberry and Margaret Howell as well. That definitely kind of all merged together with my own kind of handwriting is kind of, you know, created what Keston Hare is today, you know, the kind of the look and feel. You know, Nigel Caborn was obviously a massive influence within my kind of training as a designer. You know, UK manufacturing was really important to him. And when we were there and during the time of the designing of the Ascent for Caborn collection, which was part of my training, and I think at the time we didn't really realize how kind of how great that was going to be, you know, that whole kind of collection. And UK manufacturing was so important to Nigel, and he kind of drummed that into me. And we spent a lot of time going around and visiting factories and seeing what they were capable of. And we still use a lot of these factories now today for Keston Hare. And that's really important for us as a brand. 70% of our collection is made in the UK, and we're really proud of that.
And where are you sourcing materials from? Do you still do a lot of that legwork as well, looking for
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's, you know, if you look at our collection, it's maybe not the most kind of tricksy in terms of you know, fashion, you know, pattern cutting, or, you know, for me it's all about where it's made and the fabric and silhouette. So fabric sourcing is a massive part. You know, I spend a lot of time in my business partner Masataka is based in Japan. I spend a lot of time in Osaka in the mills there searching for unique fabrics. I spend a lot of time in Italy, so we use a lot of Japanese fabrics, a lot of Italian fabrics, and where possible, UK fabrics. And at the moment for spring summer 19, which we've just been showing in Paris and in Berlin, we're kind of reinventing garment dyeing in Scotland with Hallie Stevenson, which is a kind of a first probably for the last two decades or so. So you know, where possible, you know, I'm trying to use local fabrics. It's difficult because we're kind of trying to produce all different types of products within the collection, you know, from trousers right through to shirts and jersey. You know, we're kind of a nation of leather and tweed, and, you know, so it's impossible to kind of make everything out of local fabrics, but we try our best to kind of push the boundaries of that.
Gemma, when you talk about the brand, obviously when you're talking about a fashion line, people need to feel the clothes, they need to see the collections. But when you describe the brand and the look of it, what does that look like?
I think it's something which, as the years have gone by, we have become more confident in the fact that it's Scottish. I remember when we were first, you know, working on search terms and bios, I think we always felt initially quite cautious as to how far to push it. So we used to say that Kesson was a British designer, really interestingly, which actually now we're much more confident in the fact that he's a Scottish designer, and that we've actually now even created labels, garment labels for Spring Summer 19, which says Scotland underneath the brand name. Because I think that for us, this is absolutely 100% Kesson's USP. You know, he really is challenging the preconceptions of Scottish design. Quite often, you know, we get it a lot, is that people think that Scottish design is very cliched. It's, you know, tartan, tweed, it's, you know, thistles, but actually you can do all of those things, but you can make it look fresh and modern. And that's what Kesson is doing, is that he really is, I think, upping the ante and showing people that actually it can be so much more. And we have, you know, huge ambitions for that, that when people come to Scotland, people want to buy something from Scotland, but it tends to be relatively, you know, either from tacky Scottish tourist shops. It all seems to be very traditional. And I think that's where Kesson is now coming out in his own unique area. And for us, you know, pushing Kesson, he's very honest. Nothing to do with Kesson's brand or his clothes are pretentious or anything other than who Kesson is. He dresses, designs and dresses exactly how he and his friends. And I think that you see that in the spectrum of people who buy into the brand. It's almost like friends and family. People feel really comfortable and confident, and anybody from, you know, your dad to my brothers wear it and feel comfortable. And you can pick in and out of, you know, there are more fashion forward pieces that Kesson always produces for, you know, to, I guess, grab attention of the press. But the core product there is designed so that it lasts. The fabrics are always amazing. The quality for the price is incredible.
You know, Scotland's very important to me, and Scottish manufacturing is very important to me, and all of our knitwear for autumn winter is made in Annan in Dumfries in Scotland. They're knitted on seamless Japanese machines here in Scotland. Our technical outerwear, our seam sealed outerwear, is made in Cumbernauld, just outside Glasgow. In an ideal world, I'd like to make everything in Scotland if I possibly could. Unfortunately, that's not realistic. But we're definitely trying to work with a lot of these factories that, you know, haven't been pushed, you know, in terms of the product that they have been producing for some time. You know, they've been quite kind of traditional in terms of the types of product that they've made. But, and that's come through the kind of training with Nigel Caborn, is to go into factories and work with them very hands-on, you know. And I think that's important, and that's what's the kind of USP to the brand, really.
It's nice as well that people, I think, locally are really proud of what Kesson's doing. And the most recent collection, which is in sale at the moment, the Leithers, was all about the local people who lived in the docks, and Kesson took references, old naval references, and he always interweaves historical traits or Scottish heritage, but makes it really modern, so that you might just think, oh, I like that detail, but you wouldn't necessarily know why he's put it in there. And one of the old posties came in the other day and was handing over like a DPD package and said, you know, are you Kesson here? And he said, yeah. And he was like, I'm so you know, you make me so proud of where I live and where I come from. And it's just really nice that I think people, it's resonating with them, that they love what Kesson's doing, that he's exporting, you know, Scotland in a really, it's a new take on it.
That was Scottish fashion designer Kesson Hare and Gemma Hare speaking to Monocle's Daniel Bates. You can hear the full episode of The Entrepreneurs tomorrow at 1900 London time. You can, of course, catch up with that and all of our other programming anytime you like on our website. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. This is The Daily with me, Andrew Muller. Listeners with memories stretching back 18 months or so may recall a time during which the President of the United States was able to make public appearances without having to spend the next 24 hours explaining what he actually meant to say. Speaking earlier in Johannesburg at the annual Nelson Mandela Lecture, former President Barack Obama spoke in defense of democracy, decency, logic, and empirical fact, among other presently unfashionable ideas, while also making some pointed remarks about the necessity of resisting self-styled strongmen.
It is in part because of the failures of governments and powerful elites to squarely address the shortcomings and contradictions of this international order that we now see much of the world threatening to return to an older, a more dangerous, a more brutal way of doing business. Strongman politics are ascendant, suddenly.
Now, Barack Obama didn't mention any names, but then he didn't really have to. I'm joined now by Max de Holdervang, a geopolitics reporter with Quartz. Max, we heard a brief episode of Barack Obama speaking there. Was that pretty much a summary of the gist of what he said?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that the speech, actually, a lot of it was about global inequality and failures of current capitalism. I don't know how this entered in there, but there were, I mean, the ones that you quoted, there were remarks about how the world is changing and there are politics of fear increasing and structures of violence and repression, ancient hatreds are coming back. So it's unclear how late that was added in as a jab at Trump, but particularly I think the reference to strongman politics, it seems a fairly clear reference to Trump's meeting with Putin yesterday. I was particularly struck between how it reflected one comment Trump made yesterday. He said President Putin was extremely strong and powerful in his denial today of the Russian meddling in the US election. You know, he's clearly very much in awe of strongmen. There's a pretty clear refutal.
Is it nevertheless the case that Obama still has to fine-tune these things quite acutely so it's plausibly deniable that he was talking about Trump? He's doing that thing of, like, everyone knows what he's saying, but he can also claim he's not really saying it.
Right. I mean, exactly. Like, does he want to get into a spat in which Trump replies and then that dominates a whole news cycle? I mean, I think he understands that that's not going to be helpful. But I think, you know, his making, you know, pointedly putting these messages out where everyone knows what he's talking about, but it's not creating more of the conflict that he's decrying.
Barack Obama has always been, by general inclination, an optimist, and that's always come across very much so in his public speaking. Does he still sound like one today?
Yeah, you know, and this speech seemed kind of downbeat in some ways. I mean, there was some lovely storytelling about Mandela and you know, he was treated like an absolute idol. But there was, you know, he was not looking happy at the state of capitalism. You know, talking in Johannesburg, one of the most unequal places in the world, was pretty blunt about that. You know, and saying that, you know, the international order has, I quote, fallen short of its promise. You know, talking about the world, you know, how it used to be the case that the world was moving forward and now these old structures are back. He seemed, yes, a lot less optimistic than we've seen him in previous years. This is about changing a system rather than imagining the sort of teleological improvement that he's always talked about.
Did you get the sense of any amount of personal, if not necessarily reproach, then reflection? Because you talk about him talking about how the international order has fallen short in many respects. For 8 years there, he was the international order.
Yeah, I didn't pick up any particularly personal notes of his failures. There may have been bits of the speech that I missed there. Clearly there's some self-criticism, and you know, he absolutely backed globalization and was a big proponent of opening up free trade deals and all the rest of it. And we know that while they do spread around wealth geographically, they can often increase inequality within those countries. And And, you know, there was real criticism. I think he did mention that he finds it uncomfortable moving in the circles of the globalized elites now that he's out of office. And criticize members of that elite in you know, parts of Africa for being sort of post-ideological and not focusing on how to improve society as a whole.
I mean, the speech is a pretty astute and I guess accurate diagnosis of a lot of what is wrong with the world. Did he propose much in the way of remedies?
One thing that was interesting is he backed universal basic income. I'm trying to think of other, you know, a lot of was what he's talking about is, you know, very Obama talking about the manner of doing things. I think that's the first time that he's supported universal basic income, which is quite a big thing.
Max de Holdervang at Quartz, thank you very much. Coming up, our nightly newspaper review. Do stay tuned.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
It is time now on The Daily to take a look at the front pages. We're joined once again by Robert Fox, defence editor of the Evening Standard here in London. Robert, welcome to the newspaper review. You have a big heap of actual newspapers there. What's the first one?
The first one I've chosen is La Repubblica on the familiar theme of Trump, Putin and Helsinki. But there's an excellent piece by a real old warhorse of this world of commentating both in office and in journalism. Federico Rampini, and it's a very simple headline, Un ordinaire tramonto. It's the sunset on the old order that's been established since 1945, the thing that's persisted with NATO and so on and so forth through the Cold War. Quite a familiar thought, but he adds a real kicker towards the end, and he thinks there's some sort of vague notion, like a sort of rather alcoholic, if it's possible, for a non-drinker, pinball rattling around in Trump's head, that there can be a new world order in which the powerful, as we were hearing in the previous item, will talk to each other and there will be a three-way split. It's sort of turning Huntington on its head without Islam and saying, oh, Russia, China and the US can really manage the business of stabilisation in the world.
At which point we are in the realm of the strong do what they will and the weak suffer what they must. Yeah. I mean, does this stuff have an added resonance, do you think, in Italy, which has gone deeper in than any other Western country into sort of being governed by populists of the sort that he's writing about?
Well, anything American has a particular take in Italy because of the intimate connection through migration.
Of course.
And it's very interesting working in Italy. That it was just fun for me to hear or think all the time about the British special relations. The Italians, with very obvious from music to cuisine to other nefarious activities, feel that they've got an intimate connection with the USA and probably more intimate than that of the UK. So that is a given. But I want to sort of really rather cheat on you now because
please do.
One of the things that I follow nightly are the gobbets, the outtakes from the New Yorker that come up every night. There's about four or five essays, and very, very good reads they are too. And Masha Gessen has written about Trump and Putin.
A frequent guest on Monocle 24.
But also it is one of the best pieces I've read about the whole thing.
And that surprises me not even slightly.
Three or four dozen. But can we just kick off with this? How Putin and Trump each lied in Helsinki. And it's the art of the political lie he concentrates on. And some of the quotes that he picks up, and he translated the transcript of Putin himself again. It is two people who believe in playing the poker game of lying And he says that they have a very, very different approach to it. Putin, as you would expect, is more subtle. He comes up rather late in the day, admitting what we knew all along. For instance, you know, a year and a half later, he says, yes, Russian troops were in Ukraine, for example. And this time, and he's never actually said it in quite so many such terms. Remember, he said, yes, I was all for Trump winning this election.
He did say that out loud. I'm not entirely sure he meant to.
Masha thinks that he really does, but he then goes on with his own translation again of Putin on lying in diplomacy and intelligence. As to the question of who can or cannot be believed and whether anyone can be believed, no one can be believed. That is a direct quote from Putin.
I remember I was struck by that during the press conference.
Yeah, where did you get the idea that President Trump trusts me or that I trust him fully? He protects the interests of the United States of America. I protect the interests of the Russian Federation. And there is no such thing as truth, he seems to indicate. This is guessing. Knowability is a delusion. And then when he goes to explain, I know how these dossiers are put together. It would have even chilled the blood of Niccolo Machiavelli, I think. To hear that. And you see this extraordinary performance. But then what Trump does is he casts all over the place and starts talking about things. Nobody quite understands what he's talking about. This question of the server. Why did the FBI not take the server? You remember this came up and he brought it up again today.
He did indeed. And I think at that point he was just, as he often is, just saying words. What's the next newspaper you have in your pile there?
Well, it is Republica again, but okay. I'm going on with, they also have two stories about Matteo Salvini, who is the famous, the favourite bogeyman of EU Europe at the moment. Salvini, who's the Minister of the Interior, as well as being the leader of La Lega, as we now have to call it, not even the Northern League, wants a Trump-style gun law for self-protection in Italy. And it's a thing that he campaigned on that. But the other thing, which is yet more interesting, is that he is really pushing back against Brussels on Libyan migrants. And he is taking a leaf out of the playbook, according to Repubblica, of Silvio Berlusconi, paying the Libyans to keep their migrants at home, which is probably the Libyan what passes for various regimes across that.
Well, that would seem to be the question. If you're going to pay the Libyans to do anything at this point, which Libyans are you paying?
Well, exactly. Berlusconi paid Gaddafi quite a lot of money, about $8 billion, to set up camps. But this is where, funny enough, Republica doesn't get round to it, to saying the genie is out of the bottle. It is so chaotic, this particular outlet, this funnel, this silo of sub-Saharan migration and so on, that I don't think anybody could sit on top of it. But I do have sympathy for Salvini on this, because Brussels and Berlin and even Paris, for that matter, don't particularly want to even lift the smallest digit, really, to go out of their way to help the Italians on this one. And although the figures go up, they go down. This is a persistent, it's a perennial issue and a problem, and it's generational.
Okay, what's next in your heap then?
Well, this is another one, which is more on my beat, but sadly, I haven't been able to write about it. And it's the Super Soraway Farnborough RAF Tempest post-Brexit plane that was announced yesterday. And actually, it's a heck of a good story. Because imagine, it is not a new plane, but they've got a fully working demonstrator. They've been doing of this new Generation 6, not a fighter, but a combat plane. The Brits, who as leaky as sieves, they've kept this more or less under wraps with Italian and minority French partners for 4 years. because everybody said, poor old Britain, Brexit, Britain won't get anywhere, when the French and the Germans announced that they were going to develop a new fighter about 3 or 4 months ago, and they said they didn't want Britain involved with it. Sadly, I wished I'd been there when this was announced, but a very close friend of mine witnessed it. He said they could not believe it. The two American Air Force generals there couldn't believe it when they whipped the covers off this thing. And Rolls-Royce said, this really works. We're getting ahead. And it's a very clever move. What the Brits are doing is they're trying to leapfrog the Americans and the Europeans to say, we're going to have an international plane, all comers, you can invest in it. But they've got the money up front, about £3 billion to build this plane, which will go through from 2035 to about 2070.
How big a leap forward does the Tempest look? Or I guess what other kind of current or planned aircraft would it be comparable or a rival to?
Well, I think looking at the shape of the thing, it's a development of a thing that they developed more or less alone, BAE, British Aerospace, called the Taranis, which was a drone. This aircraft can be both manned and can be pilotless as well. It is designed to actually go ahead of the F-35, the Lightning, which is a Generation 5 fighter. It's the only one around. But it's been a bit of a dog and very, very expensive
to
develop.
Well, this is what I was going to ask. Famously, everybody hates the F-35. Is the Tempest a potential rival to it?
Oh, it will supersede it. Allegedly, the Brits are going to buy...
Everyone's going to hate the F-35 even more.
Yeah, the Brits are down to buy 138 F-35. With the arrival of Tempest on the scene, they expect it to be flying by 2035 operationally. The Brits won't even buy half that quota. They'll be lucky if they buy 60 of them. And it's where the American approach to this thing has gone terribly wrong. They were very restrictive. They were very restrictive about the transfer of technology. They said, you know, deep, long-term maintenance and midlife updates all have to be done in America. They said, no. And the Brits have said, you know, all comers welcome. And here's a funny thing. Airbus already, as we speak, is putting in phone calls saying, actually, don't exclude us from this. So it is a kind of a success. It's a Brexit plane. And what they will do, they will look at the enormous cost of the F-35 and they'll make damn sure that it doesn't get out of control like that.
Robert Fox from the Evening Standard, thanks as always for joining us. You're listening to The Daily. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. And finally tonight, if you feel like you're having a rickety week at work, spare a thought for the producers of the much ballyhooed Chinese fantasy epic Asura. The film, backed by a consortium of major Chinese studios, reportedly cost more than $100 million to make. On its opening weekend, it scraped up a figure which translates from the Chinese as a great deal less than that. The shepherd's crook has swiftly descended, and Asura is now apparently poised for either a brisk reworking or an embarrassed interring beneath several feet of reinforced concrete. I'm joined now by the film critic Karen Krasanovich. How bad can it be?
The Shepherd's Crook. I love it. It can be very, very bad. And actually, we're sort of, I mean, of course we feel bad that this film's been pulled because it's a bad thing. It's hurtful to the filmmakers. But secretly, we're sort of happy because this could never happen in the Western world.
But that the film could just get yanked
could never just
off the
yank
screen.
Like, no, you could never, The Shepherd's Crook, I'm sorry, I can't recover. You could never just say, it's a failure, we're pulling it. It doesn't happen.
Well, what has gone wrong here? Is it just that the film sucked and it was obviously going to suck and therefore nobody really wanted to go and see it?
I think, okay, on the good side, the Chinese are going, we made a film, it's not so popular. Let's redo it. It's a do-over. It's like in golf. You just pretend, I didn't shoot that ball. I'm just going to do it over.
Are they going to redo it, or are we just never going to hear from this?
No, they will definitely redo it. Yes, they will.
Can you do that, though, just from a cinematic perspective? Is there much precedent for a film being released, everybody hating it and or ignoring it, it therefore being returned to barracks, rethought, remixed? I mean, it happens a lot in music. Like an initial mix or an initial production doesn't quite take, so they have another whack at it until they get it right. Can you do that with a film?
Kubrick did it, actually.
True enough.
Yes, he did. But anyway, there isn't a lot of precedent because it takes a lot of power to do that. There are a lot of egos, a lot of money involved. But in order to recoup sunk costs, they're going to take it back. There's a lot of extra footage. Don't forget, this film took 6 years to make. A lot of extra footage. And they're just going to bring in some different editors, maybe do some sort of reshoots, I don't think. But they'll just change the order. And they'll see where they went wrong and they'll re-release it.
See, I've always been fascinated, if not that I ever actually want to watch the films, but the psychology, the group psychology of cinematic disasters kind of interests me because it's much more interesting. It's really easy to see how bad books get written. You just need one deluded author and one deluded publisher. It's easy to see how bad records get made. You need four people who can't tell that their band's terrible and a briefly gullible producer and record label and so on. But a film, especially a film of this size, thousands of people would have worked on it, as you point out, for 6 years. How do you keep together 6 years, thousands of people, without one person just going, this is going to suck?
You don't do that. That's not your job. If you work in, it's actually the producer's job, or it's actually the producer's job or the director's job, or actually, to be honest, it's nobody's job. Nobody says, this is a really bad film, we're not going to release it. Because, you know, it's like giving birth to a child going, it's too ugly, let's kill it. No, you don't do that, right? So you just think, okay, where can we find this ugly child a home? That's how it goes. And that's what you have to do.
I mean, is this kind of thing inevitable, part of the learning process as China develops what I'm sure it hopes will be a film business of global standard and global stature?
Well, you know, I had dinner tonight with another film professional. We saw Ant-Man and Wasp Woman, which is amazing, by the way. Go and see it. And we were discussing this. No, you'll love it, believe me.
Okay.
And we were discussing this, that it's a cumulative effort, and we all just do the best we can, and we just hope that it gets marketed the right way.
I mean, is it just the marketing, though? Have the Chinese realized that the whole sort of epic fantasy genre has reached its point of being oversubscribed?
It's not that, actually. It's the fact is that globally, and this is why this is such an interesting story, globally, nobody knows what's going to be a hit now. I saw Mamma Mia 2 today, which will be a hit with the Love Island.
Why would you do that?
You say I've got Bell's palsy. No, it's because I'm a professional, Andrew. It's, okay, nobody knows what's going to be a hit. It doesn't matter how much you spend. I mean, $150 million on this one, $15 million on the other one, that was a hit. This one isn't.
Well, as a wise man once said, indeed, nobody knows anything. Karen Krasanovich, thank you, as always, for joining us. That is it for today's edition of The Daily. It was produced by Ben Ryland and Daniel Bates. The researchers were Daphne Karnesis and Julia Webster. Our studio manager was David Stevens. The Globalist is live 8 hours from now. The Daily returns at 2200 London time tomorrow. And playing us out in tribute to China's blockbuster flop, Asura, we leave you with a hit from 1983, taken from the soundtrack to the quite strange film of the same year, Electric Dreams, about a man who falls in love with a computer, which perhaps unsurprisingly doesn't go brilliantly. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.